Welcome back, Question Mess. In 2018, this is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Here we go. This is a royal podcast. A royal podcast on a royal day for a royal wedding, for which I can say I don't give a royal rat's behootie about. But with that being said, let's get to the medical literature. So without further ado, without further hesitation, any reservation, hopefully no constipation, because this podcast is about to stuff up your brain hole like a pound full of cheese. Let's kick it off. All right, Question Mess. In 2018, there are so many articles and so little time, so let's get going on it. And just a reminder, before I even talk about any of the articles, if you like any of these articles, don't waste time looking them up. Don't waste time asking your librarian. Just reach out to me on Twitter at Andrew Bilt or email me, andrewbilt@gmail.com. Bilt is B-U-E-L-T. And I will send them to you. I'll send them to you within 24 hours. I do not care. We used to put them up on the website, used to do all this work. And then I realized something very important. For about every 100 or 120 listeners, one of you would visit the website and download or go through the articles. Meaning, it was a whole lot of work on my side to put the articles up with such a little number of you actually going to read the articles. But if you want to read them, please, by all means, let me know and I will give them to you. I will send them your way. In fact, if you want to then just read them and we can Skype and talk medicine and discuss them, totally okay with me. Just let me know. If you are a resident or a faculty member at some residency program and you want me to do your grand rounds or some kind of talk, Skype. Let's Skype it in. Let's do it. Let's get this thing going. All right. Enough with that. Let's get down to the medical literature from down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Here we go. And I guess before we get there, let's back it up for just a second. I recently did a piece that'll be out in months from now on a thoracic aortic aneurysm. And I'm talking about treatment. In it, I was talking about the treatment of thoracic or aortic aneurysm. I talk about the guidelines. I talk about what medications should we use. If you want to hear it in its entirety, then primary care reviews and perspectives, like I said, a few months from now. But let me give you the quick, the dirty, the short, the nitty-gritty, if you will. Let's say you get a CAT scan. Maybe it comes from the ER, and it says, oh, by the way, there's this thoracic aortic aneurysm here. Incidental finding. What do you do with that? What medications should you put them on? Should you put them on a beta blocker? A beta blocker, right? We know it's a beta blocker. Well, when you actually look at the data, all in all, less than 1,000 patients ever studied on this. And this is in Marfan's patients. We don't know how that applies to the general population. So beta blockers, meh, not very good evidence. Then you might be saying, what about the angiotensin receptor blocker, the ACE inhibitors, if you will, the ARBs, if you will? That must be beneficial, right? Again, meh. In fact, I found one paper online, medical treatment for thoracic aortic aneurysms. Much more work to be done. And it probably summed it up better than anything, and I will quote them, and what they say is that the precise role of angiotensin receptor blockers has yet to be proven in clinical trials, with the majority of supporting scientific evidence emerging from the drug's effectiveness in mouse models. The human studies are really lacking, and when they do show benefit, it's pediatric patients, again, with Marfans. I don't know how that works with adults without Marfans. And you might be saying, what about statins? Statins, we should have them in the water, right? Well, the observational studies suggest that there may be a benefit, but to date, there is no prospective randomized clinical trial that has been conducted looking at statin therapy on prevention of thoracic aortic aneurysms, growth rupture, or the need for repair. So, again, just stick with the guidelines. If they're high risk, get them on a statin. If they're not high risk, probably don't need a statin because we don't really have evidence saying that they do anything in the low-risk population. So, take home. If you see one, just follow the guidelines. Recheck, rescan in the 6 months. Make sure it's not growing. When it does start to grow, refer to a vascular surgeon. Continue to follow it up as you always would and make sure that they stop smoking, make sure that they're eating right, diet and exercise, all the things that you would already do, go ahead and keep doing. There's no magic pill for this. It is an incidental finding that we incidentally work up and we incidentally freak out over, but we probably shouldn't because we can't really do much about it other than what we're hopefully already doing. All right, now on to the medical literature. In JAMA, April 17, 2018, a paper titled Association Between Use of Sodium Glucose Cotransporter 2 Inhibitors, GLP-1 Agonists, and DDP or DPP-4 Inhibitors with All-Cause Mortality in Patients with Type 2 Diabetes. I find this paper pretty important because it's looking at an outcome that we can all get on board with, which is mortality. And in the end, the use of SGLT2 inhibitors or the GLP-1 agonists were associated with better mortality outcomes than the DPP-4 inhibitors. I think if you've looked at any of the literature on these drugs, this probably does not come as a surprise to you. However, I still see the DPP-4 inhibitors getting prescribed way more frequently than they probably should, and I can only help but think that it's probably has something to do with Big Pharma. In the conclusions of this paper, and I'll read it directly, the use of DPP-4 inhibitors was not associated with lower mortality than placebo or no treatment. Well, if it doesn't beat placebo on the thing that we care about, then it probably doesn't really matter. And I had actually this conversation with the endocrinologist at my hospital, and the argument was, well, the DPP-4 inhibitors actually have better prandial or mealtime correction of hyperglycemia. The question becomes, what does that really matter if they're dead? Because again, the mortality benefit is no better than a sugar pill. Well, maybe a sugar pill, because sugar might raise your glucose, but no better than a baking soda pill, if you will. So for me, I'm not prescribing the DPP-4 inhibitors. I mean, I've put out a podcast on this one way back when, probably 2 years ago now, on the DPP-4 inhibitors. Much of that evidence still remains the same. And while we're on the topic of the funk for the chunk, type 2 diabetes, there's a paper in Lancet 2018 titled Primary Care Led Weight Management for Remission. That's right, remission of type 2 diabetes in open label cluster randomized trial. This is the DIRECT study, and I think that this will get pushed in the future. There's significant amount of literature now saying if you lose weight, you might lose your diabetes. Now, of course, I mean if you lose weight as in diet and exercise, not necessarily getting your toe cut off as some diabetics try to lose their weight. This study took the patients, they put them on a restricted calorie diet, the restricted diet being about 800 calories a day for 3 to 5 months, and then they slowly reintroduce food with maintenance and education, and the primary outcome here was weight loss of 15 kilograms. That's a lot of weight, over 30 pounds. And they were also looking at the remission of diabetes A1C less than 6.5 after at least 2 months off all their anti-diabetic medications. And listen to some of these results. At 12 months, those in the intervention group had a weight loss of 15 kilograms or more in 25% of the participants compared to the intervention group, which had zero, or the control group, I mean, had zero participants with a weight loss of 15 kilograms or more. And diabetes remission was achieved in about half of the participants in the intervention group and only 4% of the participants in the control group. And you might be saying, Andrew, who cares? You talk about surrogate outcomes. Well, this is a surrogate outcome. Well, maybe not, because they also looked at the quality of life. The quality of life on a visual analog scale improved by 7.2 points in the intervention group, and it decreased by 2.9 points in the control group, adjusted difference there of 6.4 points, which was statistically significant, meaning not only are you losing weight, you're losing your diabetes, and you're maybe losing your depression, you're losing your frustration, you're losing all these other baggages that come with your obesity and your diabetes right along with it. You're happier, you're healthier, you're off to a better life. Which is why I think, and I've said this many times, I even tweeted it out earlier this week, is that maybe diabetes should actually be called you haven't exercised and you ate too much syndrome. Let's just call it what it is. In order to lose diabetes, you need to exercise significantly more and eat significantly less. And according to this paper, the significantly less is probably right about 800 calories a day. If you go back through the archives of Question Medicine, just a few podcasts ago, I talked about how if you're on bisphosphate therapy for osteoporosis and you're on it long term, I mean 6, 7, 8, 9 years, it seemed to not necessarily be better than if you were just on it for 4 or 5 years. This was suggesting we need a drug holiday. We know that we need drug holidays when it comes to the bisphosphonate drugs. The question becomes, how long should this drug holiday be? Well, this paper in Endocrine Practice from February 2018 titled Osteoporotic Fractures During Bisphosphonate Drug Holiday might do a little bit to answering that question. This was a retrospective chart review of just over 400 patients with osteopenia or osteoporosis who had taken a bisphosphonate drug holiday between 2004 and 2013. During that time frame, 15% of the patients developed a fracture during the follow-up. The yearly incidence of fractures range anywhere from about 3.5% all the way up to 10%, and this peaked at about 10% during years 4 and 5 respectively. All in all, this means that likely we should have a drug holiday, but don't get it up to 4 years because there is a significant increased risk, 1 in 10, that roughly at 4 years of a drug holiday, you are going to get a fracture, or going to have a fracture, and we do not want that, not at all. So I think here's what we know about osteoporosis so far. Only screen them with the DEXA one time, or for the majority of patients, one time once they fit the criteria. And if you have an index of suspicion that they actually might have osteoporosis, if you don't have the index of suspicion, you're probably okay not screening them. But if you screen them one time. As I've written about before, talked about before, the DEXA scan is not accurate enough to pick up changes in your therapy, in your management. Don't screen them more than once. It is a waste of time, a waste of money, and a waste of resources. Once you screen them, if they have osteoporosis, not osteopenia, osteoporosis, because if we only have 5 years to treat these patients, let's not start the treatment while they're in the pre-disease condition. Let's save that until they reach the disease condition. So, if they're in osteoporosis, you can start therapy. Start therapy 5 years, roughly. Then, drug holiday. Drug holiday for 3 years. Then, restart it back up. How long do we restart it back up for? At this point, we don't really know. But if you use that with your patient tomorrow, that buys us 8-ish years until we have to answer that next question. And by then, I think we'll have more details and individual patient analysis. Now, while we're on the topic of osteoporosis, what does one do? What does one do when osteoporosis leads to a compression fracture? Well, we all want to do something, and out of something has been born the vertebroplasty, because patients that have compression fractures are in pain, and we don't want to stand there. We want to do something. Well, this BMJ paper, titled Vertos IV Trial, looked at 180 patients, mean age 76, and 76% of those patients were female. The patients had to have anywhere from 1 to 3 vertebral compression fractures, and then they were randomized to vertebroplasty or a sham intervention. The vertebroplasty was the real deal. It was the real surgery. You went into surgery, and bada boom, bada bing, you got it. The sham intervention was a sham surgery. They simulated the cementation they used with vertebral and physical clues. They took them into the OR. They did the whole thing. It was a sham surgery. And what do you know? The primary outcome here was self-reported pain on a visual analog scale, which is important, right? We are doing this to hopefully improve your pain. Pain is a subjective finding, so the visual analog scale, that's as good as we got. If you look at the baseline scores in two groups were right about 7.8. After 1 month, the mean pain score, right about 3.5. And after 12 months, the mean pain score, right about 3. There was really no difference. No difference between vertebroplasty and a sham intervention or sham surgery. I think we have to look, what does this mean? Can we just take these people to sham surgery? I mean, how awesome would that be? I don't know. I think, again, this has to do with the mind. The mind is so powerful. And if we can somehow convince these patients that, listen, I'm going to give you this diclofenac gel. I'm going to give you this gabapentin. I'm going to give you this whatever it may be. Maybe a little diabetic needle injection in your back, because we know that things that are invasive actually do better than things that are not invasive. Give them really big pills that they're supposed to take 6 times a day, but just make them like placebo pills. Things that are, they think are important, and we know are probably just sham and placebo, will probably go a long way for the management of compression fractures. All right, I got to wrap this up. But so far, we've really only talked about two topics, diabetes and osteoporosis. So let's make this a topic-based podcast, and let's talk about one more topic. Topic is atrial fibrillation, and really the treatment of atrial fibrillation. First of all, I got to say, I hate that the NOACs or DOACs, whatever you want to call them, I'm going to call them NOACs because that's what I like to call them. They say NOACs should not be used in valvular atrial fibrillation. What they should say is that NOACs shouldn't be used in non-mitral stenosis AFib, not non-valvular, because really what they're saying is that NOACs shouldn't be used in mitral stenosis. There's 4 valves. Why do they call it valvular AFib? They should just call it mitral stenosis AFib. That's just a little pet peeve of mine. Fresh out of the box from the Heart Rhythm Scientific Sessions, there was a poster or a release from a clinical trial titled "Lower Adherence Direct Oral Anticoagulants Use is Associated with Increased Risk of Thromboembolic Events Than Warfarin. Understanding the Real-World Performance of Systemic Anticoagulation in Atrial Fibrillation." That's a huge title. That's a huge title, but basically what they were trying to say is that, as we know, DOACs, NOACs, they're better than warfarin. They're better than warfarin in most of the trials. Definitely non-inferior for sure, and probably beat warfarin in most situations. However, in those trials, that's probably, and by probably I mean most likely, if you are getting phone calls, if you're getting reminded, if you're getting paid every day to take your pill, you are super compliant. If you're one of those patients that never misses a pill, then this drug is for you. However, if you are one of those patients that says, meh, sometimes I miss it, sometimes I don't. I have 3 kids, although I was on birth control the entire time because I'm just not that compliant with my medications, then maybe this isn't for you. Maybe warfarin is where you need to go. And the more adherent you are to the medication, the better the medications work. In this study, the event rates were reported for warfarin and the NOACs at higher adherence. So meaning if you were actually taking the medication as prescribed for greater than 80% of the days, and then low adherence was covering 40 to 80% of the days. This was a huge study. I mean, we're talking over 50,000 patients for each arm. And all in all, it kind of showed what I said earlier. If you have high adherence to your medication, using it more than 80% as prescribed every day that you're using it, well, then the DOACs, NOACs beat out warfarin, no doubt. But if you're not, then they're about one and the same. If you're using it only as prescribed 40 to 80% of the time, warfarin is as good, you know, if not better, than DOACs. Statistically speaking, no difference there. Now, as was mentioned on Twitter, to the response to the next article, once a fibber, always a fibber. That has to do with AFib, that is. Now, of course, we would like to think that if we have you in AFib and we convert you out of AFib, then you are out of AFib forever and ever and ever. But the only real way that we could ever tell this is if we put a monitor on you and then monitored you 24/7, 365, 366 on a leap year. That's the only way we would ever know, because most patients don't necessarily know when they go in and out of AFib. And are they going in and out of AFib when they're sleeping? Are they going in and out just a little bit here and there when they exercise and they don't even notice or sense it, and then they go back in with normal sinus rhythm? We don't know. However, We know that AFib puts you at a greater increased risk of stroke, and we know that strokes are bad. I would venture to say strokes are one of the worst outcomes in medicine that we possibly have. So, once you're in AFib, should you stay on anticoagulation forever? Because typically, once you go back into normal sinus rhythm, you get off your anticoagulants. However, this paper just published, April, BMJ, looked at the rate of strokes and TIAs and all-cause mortality in patients with a diagnosed, quote-unquote, resolved AFib compared to patients with unresolved AFib and compared to patients that had never, ever had AFib. This was two different retrospective cohort studies. And the main outcome that they were looking for was what was the incidence of stroke or a TIA. In the end, the bottom line here is that if you had AFib, you were at high, and it resolved. We think that you're in normal sinus rhythm now all the time. You still had a greater risk of stroke or TIA than patients who had never had AFib. Now that didn't matter even if you didn't have a diagnosis of recurrent atrial fibrillation. So, or paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, it didn't matter. If we just think you've had AFib and now you're out of AFib, we think you're normal sinus rhythm, you had an increased risk of stroke. I think that this paper will lead to more studies, and I think, don't quote me on this, it'll be 5-10 years, but I think that this will push that if you have someone that comes in with AFib, and this is primary AFib, not secondary, they're not in the hospital and then get pneumonia and then it's resolved in 48 hours. No, this is... they're happy, talking, walking down the street, and boom, into AFib without any kind of predisposition or any kind of trigger that we can figure out. And then we get them back into normal sinus rhythm, and they are at low risk of bleeding. We should probably keep them on anticoagulation for life. Because taking a pill stinks. Taking an expensive pill stinks probably a little bit more. But getting or having a stroke is the ultimate stinko. So... I think this is probably where the literature is going, and this tends to make sense. I think that realistically speaking, I think we've all seen it. People that go into AFib, and it's primary AFib, rarely for a lifetime stay out of AFib. It's the paroxysmal. They come back in every now and then. It's 48 hours. We know we go to ablation. I mean, does that even work with the Cabana trial that just came out? Oh my goodness, I didn't even talk about that. But my time is up because I can hear the music coming. So I'm going to end this podcast like I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.